Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
With Mitt Romney taking a lead in the Republican Party's presidential primary, many folks in the nation are becoming interested in knowing more about his religious faith. As has been well publicized, Mr. Romney is a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, whose adherents are commonly referred to as Mormons. In past episodes of this show, we have featured economist Mike McBride discussing the institutional organization of the LDS Church, and historian Patrick Mason on the historical instances of anti-Mormonism. Today, I thought we'd take a look at another well-known facet of life for many Mormons, the missionary trip. Young members of the Latter-day Saints are known to walk around in pairs, knocking on the doors of strangers to tell these folks about their faith. This not only happens here in the United States, but it is common to see these young men and women spending 2 years abroad in a foreign country, sometimes in situations where they are not altogether welcomed. To better understand what goes on during one of these trips, I'm pleased to have as my guest Allison Pond. Allison was an LDS missionary from 1997 to 1998 in Russia, a country where she had previously served as an English teacher just prior to her religious sojourn. Allison also holds a bachelor's degree in journalism from BYU, earned in 2000, and received her graduate degree from Georgetown in 2005. Following her education, she was employed at the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life for 6 years, and currently serves as a reporter for the Deseret News in Utah. I discovered Allison after reading her recent piece for the Houses of Worship column in the Wall Street Journal, wherein she documented some of the issues related to Mormon missionizing. Today, we'll explore those themes a bit deeper and hopefully get a chance to talk about the changing religious landscape in Russia that she has experienced, particularly since she recently returned to Russia in 2010 with the well-honed sensibilities of a seasoned journalist and researcher. Allison, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Now, before proceeding to some of our questions that I have for you, I should note that we are recording this on January 6th of 2012, and that's important since in the introduction I mentioned that Mitt Romney was the leading candidate in the GOP presidential primary, but we really have only had the good folks of Iowa weighing in on this so far, and it's shaping up to be a pretty volatile primary season. And as of this show, as this show will be airing in early February, after folks in New Hampshire and South Carolina are going to get their chance to voice their preferences, who knows if Mitt Romney will still be in the lead or not. So now this is probably an unfair question for you, Allison, but I have to ask if you have any prognostications about how all of this presidential stuff is going to shake out.
Well, you'll be able to compare my prognostications to what actually happens. I don't know about that.
I know. That's kind of what's the neat thing about doing this kind of a time sync or out of sync or something.
You know, well, I mean, it looks to me, like to a lot of people, like it's Romney's nomination to lose, but he certainly could do that. This race hasn't really lent itself to any easy prognostication, so I'm as interested to see what happens as everyone else.
And I can only imagine that people in Utah are following this pretty closely.
I think that's right. I mean, they're definitely watching, and I think that Mormons are watching, sort of holding their breath with a lot of different mixed feelings, and it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, that's true. And in my earlier podcast with Patrick Mason, where we did talk about historical anti-Mormonism, the end of that podcast, we did talk about how this might all play out and affect Mitt Romney and, again, John Huntsman, still in the race as of the recording of this podcast right now, and he's also with the Latter-day Saints. So, you know, we'll see how that goes. And for those of you folks who are interested in that earlier podcast with Patrick Mason or the one with Michael
McBride. Please do visit our website and check these out. They're in the archives. They're in perpetuity. And if you're also interested, please do check our Facebook page. You can link to us right there on our website at www.researchonreligion.org. So let's get to this whole missionary stuff. And I usually start out my interviews with practitioners or people who've done religion by asking a bit about their early background. And now, although you're a journalist, we are interviewing you as a person involved in the religious scene as a foreign missionary. So I'm going to start with some basic info about your upbringing. Were you raised in a religious home? And if so, whereabouts?
I was actually raised in quite a religious home. I was raised in the LDS church. We moved around a lot when I was growing up. I remember living in California. I went to kindergarten and first grade in Mexico City. Later, lived in Michigan and Kentucky. And as I said, my family was always pretty religious. Everywhere that we moved, we found a congregation and attended. I remember my parents having family home evenings, which is something that a lot of the LDS Church encourages its members to have once a week with their families. And wherever we were, my parents were always serving in the church in some kind of leadership capacity. So it was definitely something that was really engendered in me from a young age.
Well, let me ask you about the moving around part, because when you did move around, was it always a consideration or one of the primary considerations that if you move somewhere, there had to be a Mormon stake somewhere that you could plant roots at?
I don't think that was a consideration in the sense that, you know, we would or wouldn't move somewhere based on that. It's kind of incredible, though, that everywhere we did move, and really almost anywhere that you could move, there is some kind of church organization where people tend to find each other. Sometimes a stake will cover just a few city blocks in Salt Lake City, but sometimes it'll take the entire state of Kentucky. But there's usually always something. There was something there for us to plug into and be a part of.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking when you had mentioned Kentucky, because I know California has a very large Mormon population, Mexico City as well. But Kentucky, I'm still a little surprised there. So now the other thing in terms of getting to your missionary trip, you were raised in a very religious household. Did you always know that you were going to eventually go on a mission trip?
I didn't. It's something that in the church they talk about a lot more for young men than for young women. It's sort of expected of the young men, and it's a choice for the young women. And it didn't really ever occur to me that that's something I would be interested in until around the time when I was at BYU. After my freshman year, I served as a counselor for a youth program they had called Academy for Girls. So I was mentoring some 13 to 14-year-old girls. It was like a 10-day youth camp counselor kind of a thing. And that experience of watching kind of their lives change, it was a spiritually oriented kind of a camp. And just that feeling of helping somebody else spiritually, teaching somebody something, you know, in that way, it really developed my own faith, and it really made me think about wanting, if serving a mission was like that, then that was something that I was interested in. So I still had a couple of years to go before that, but the idea stuck with me, and when I was 21, which is the age that young women go, then that was the decision I made.
So let me ask a little bit about your experience at BYU. I want to come back to the missionary thing in a second, but one of the things that has interested me at BYU, it's a Mormon university, and you know the student body population is predominantly Mormon. When I've been there, and I've been the guest a couple times, wonderful host out there, I noticed that there are a lot of 18 and 19-year-olds, especially men, and then there's a gap. Then all of a sudden you see a bunch of 22 and 23-year-olds, which really makes for an interesting university environment, because you have, you know, your typical high school kid coming in, going to college, and then they're sent away for 2 years. And we'll talk a little bit more about what happens during those 2 years and the maturation process that occurs. But there's a significant difference in the older students, the juniors and seniors who are there. Did you get that sense or that feeling as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the mission experience really does change you in a lot of ways. I mean, it's something where you're really forced to grow up pretty quickly, take on a lot of responsibility, and And I think there's a big difference between people before they leave and when they come back. You know, the other way that that affected me at BYU is in terms of dating, where you have so many young men who leave from age 19 to 21, and it not only affects your numbers, but the skew in ages is always provides all kinds of things for young co-eds to analyze and work through.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting that you mentioned about, as you say, and we're going to explore reasons why this is a little while later in the interview about women on these missionary trips. But yeah, if the women don't go as often as men, you're going to have that two-year gap. And I don't know, 2 years is not that big. My wife and I are more than 2 years apart. Mm-hmm. But I can imagine at that age that becomes an issue.
Yeah, and you know, some girls will wait for a missionary that they have out that they want to marry when he gets back, and others will date older boys or younger boys, or kind of however it works out. And there's still quite a high marriage rate at that university as well, so it's always in the air.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So yeah, that might be an interesting sociological study for somebody if we have any graduate students out there fishing around for a thesis or so. That'd be rather interesting. Well, let's get back to the missionary process. So you were working at the Academy of Girls, and your faith is being intensified, and you're saying, hey, missionary work, that might be something that I'm interested in doing. And now, as you mentioned, it's more expected of young men than young women. So for you as a woman, how did you go about getting to that missionary trip? How did you sniff it out? Did you have to talk to people? Did somebody come and recruit you? What is going on here?
Well, the way that people end up on a mission, when you make that decision you want to go, your ecclesiastical leader, the leader of your congregation, the bishop, is the person who you meet with first. You let him know that you're interested in going. They have a set of missionary papers that you fill out. You have an interview with your bishop and then with your stake president, who's over a set of congregations. And I think you also have to have a medical screening. And then you take those papers signed by the bishop and the stake president and submit them to Salt Lake City. And so it's a pretty straightforward and easy process. And so to get the ball rolling, you just go in and talk to your bishop, and he'll counsel with you about your decision to do that.
Yeah, actually, you say it's a pretty straightforward process. That actually sounds like there's a lot more steps than I anticipated. The interview process that goes on can you tell us anything about the interview process?
Oh, I don't know how much I remember. I'm sure my bishop asked me why I wanted to serve, and I think at the time my bishop may actually, I can't remember, it might have been my uncle at that time in my ward in Colorado where I was from, where I went to high school, and that was the ward that I left from for my mission. But they will ask you questions about your faith and the way that you live your faith and things like that. And I can't remember very many more details. I don't know if there's, a specific set of questions that they ask or anything. But
yeah. Well, they're probably, like any missionary going out to the field, most people understand it's going to be a pretty difficult time. It's not easy. And so they're going to figure out, what your personality composition is in that. How is it determined where you end up going? Are individuals matched to, for example, your language skills or your personal background? You might have come from the Ukraine or you had family in the Ukraine, so you would obviously be a Ukrainian missionary.
The process for that is actually really interesting. So all of the missionary papers are received in Salt Lake City. And members of the Quorum of the Twelve, which is the top governing council of the church, one or more members of that group will sit in a room. And from what I've been told, they have what I've read about, they have a series of screens, and they will, there'll be members of the Quorum of the Twelve, others from the missionary department, or people who are participating in the selection process, and they begin with a prayer, and then as they go through one by one, these missionaries that have submitted papers, they'll see their face on a screen. They'll see a screen with places in the world where they have needs for missionaries, and they'll look through those papers and what background experiences, what languages, what other things that missionary may have, and match people to places in the world where they have a need for missionaries. And You know, so there are some practical considerations, but there's also a strong element of seeking for inspiration to find, you know, the right place for that missionary to serve. And sometimes, in my case, I already had some background in the Russian language, and so serving in Russia was a great fit and was exciting for me. But there are also stories of people who've spent their whole life learning a foreign language. Maybe they learned German and then got sent to Japan or something like that. And so there's no guarantee of any of it, and it's an assignment that you choose to accept wherever they choose to send you.
Yeah, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you, because you said you were a teacher of English in Russia for a semester beforehand. So this must have been through some, was it a BYU program or other Teach for the World program?
Yeah, it was called the International Language Program.
Okay.
It was a nonprofit organization based out of Provo.
Mm-hmm. And when you were there in Russia, did you have any sense that you would be returning there as a missionary? Because I think there's a pretty rapid succession between when you did your work as a teacher in Russia and then when you went on your mission.
Yeah, so I was in Russia in the fall of 1996 as a teacher, and I knew that I was going to be turning 21 in March. And so while I was there, I was thinking about this and kind of making that decision about whether to serve a mission. And I remember one night when I was walking home with some friends from somewhere down a street in Moscow, and looking around, and I just sort of had this thought. It wasn't like, you know, a lightning bolt or a vision or anything, but it was just kind of a thought that I'm gonna go on a mission. And then it was followed by the thought that I'm gonna be back in Russia. And it was sort of a sense that it could happen or that it might happen. The whole time that I was waiting to find out where I would be serving, I was really hopeful that I would be going back to Russia, but also trying really hard not to get my hopes up too much and to realize that that serving a mission was, you know, sharing the gospel anywhere, and that I would, you know, try to be willing to go anywhere that I was sent. But I was really happy to open up my letter and find out that I'd be going to Russia.
Oh, that sounds pretty cool. So what about your preparation for the trip? You open up your letter, you're going to Russia, you're pretty excited about this. Now, your experience, you already had Russian language skills, I would assume.
Yeah, to a certain extent.
Okay. Yeah, everybody has the language training. And then when you get to the field, you realize how much language training you didn't have.
Right.
But, you know, so talk not only about your experience, but perhaps generalize to other missionaries. Is there a certain set of procedures you go through to get prepared for this mission trip? Is there language training? Do you attend classes, for example, on how to missionize and perhaps how to deal with difficult situations, or they just put you on a plane and ship you off and say, there you are?
I'm really glad that didn't happen.
Okay.
No, actually, there's a fascinating place called the Missionary Training Center that is adjacent to Brigham Young University in Provo. That missionaries who are going on a foreign mission will stay there for 2 months. They have a set of dormitories and classrooms, and those who are not learning a language will spend about 3 weeks there. So I was there for 2 months in the MTC, and we had some returned missionaries who had served in Russia before who taught us. We had three sets of classes every day for about 3 hours each, when we would do scripture study, we would do language study, and we would also study missionary skills about how to teach, how to communicate, how to find people. So these were people who had been there and done it for 18 months or 2 years, who trained us pretty intensively for 2 months. And you have speakers from church leadership in Salt Lake come and talk and, you know, get you excited about going on a mission. And I mean, it's a very intense 2 months. And by the end of it, I was really excited to actually get to the country. But that preparation, I think, makes an enormous difference in the experience that missionaries have once they arrive in country.
Did other people in your cohort in that missionary training center share the same thing? Or is there a possibility that some people will wash out after 2 weeks, say, whoa, this is not for me?
I think that certainly does happen. There wasn't anyone in my cohort or my group but I've definitely heard stories of that. And, you know, I think that missionary work, whether in the Mormon Church or any other, is something where you're sharing something from your heart, and it's your faith. And if it's not something that you feel driven to do, if it's not something that you have that personal connect with, in a sense, I imagine that it would be excruciatingly difficult. And You know, I was pretty young at the time, and I'm not sure that I was as aware or empathetic maybe as I could have been to missionaries who were going through that. But looking back and hearing stories, I think that it definitely happens, but I'm surprised that it doesn't seem to happen more than it does in one sense.
Well, that whole 2 month intensive language training, it must be pretty incredible. I'm somebody who I know Spanish, but boy, languages come really difficult to me. And, you know, to learn a new language, especially for folks who are, say, going to Japan or China, you know, Asian language is for English speakers are immensely difficult. That's got to be tough.
Oh, absolutely. I think, and you know, that time, it's really intellectually stimulating, emotionally grueling. It's a very intense several months, and some missionaries, it comes easier than others, and everyone's at a different point by the time they get to the country. But really, if you haven't had any language training before that, it's pretty hard within 2 months to get to any point of fluency. And so everybody, I think, has the experience once they arrive in country of hitting the ground and thinking that they are, you know, are so excited, they've got their phrases learned, they're ready to talk to someone, and then talking to a native and just not understanding a word that is coming out of their mouth.
Yeah,
you know? And so the preparation is certainly helpful, and I can't imagine what it would be like without it, but really just getting there and doing it is the most important way to learn and get to the next level.
I want to focus a little bit more on the training aspect that you received during those 2 months before we get to hitting the ground there. We recently talked with Jeff Rose about street preaching. He's a street preacher, and he recounted some situations where people would jeer at him, they would throw things his way, and he even had an experience where he was threatened with a knife. Knowing that religious minorities are often the target of violence in various places around the world, were you given any preparation for dealing with these kind of situations?
We were given some, and like I said, the three teachers that we had in the MTC were those who had served missions before, and you know, we heard all of their stories, we heard you know, their experiences, and then for once we arrived in country, there's for each geographic area, there's a mission president who's usually an older, more established man, not, you know, one of the young missionaries, who supervises. In our case, in my mission, I think we had about 80 or 90 missionaries at any given time.
And he's out there in the field. He would have been in Russia.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And when you get to the field, you go straight to the mission home, meet the president, and get some orientation for your specific mission where you're going to be serving. You've also got strong ties with other missionaries who are there. And there were a lot of precautions taken in the mission where I served. We didn't wear our little black name tags, for example, for most of the time that I was a missionary, because we were concerned about possible hostility and things like that. And so there were stories of elders in my mission who at one point were held at gunpoint or knife point, or there were things that definitely did happen, and I think that we knew that because we were Americans and because we were missionaries that we could be a target at any time. Thankfully, I never encountered anything like that, but it wasn't unheard of.
Yeah, so you say it's not unheard of, so you must have heard of it to some degree. Were you concerned about experiencing hostility before you started your mission trip? I can imagine at the beginning of the 2 month training period, you're ready to go. But then as the clock starts ticking down and, you know, now you arrive at the airport and you're on the plane, you're flying out to Moscow, all of a sudden something go in your head, say, oh, what am I doing? This could be kind of dangerous. Or the fact that you had some experience previously in Russia, did that help?
Yeah, you know, So, yes, I was concerned, but I think there's also, you know, I remember being in the missionary training center, and, or maybe it was right after I got into Russia, and my mom emailed me an article, she mailed me in the mail, an article from the Denver Post about some of the political things that were going on in Russia, where they were passing these laws to curb religion and you know, the pressure from the Orthodox Church and Human Rights Watch and others were upset about all of this. And I read it, but in some sense, I kind of felt a little bit removed from it. I think that because I felt like I had so much faith in what I was doing, what I wanted to do, and you know, that God wanted me to go there, and that there's this sense that you'll be protected, you know. In some ways, the if there's opposition, it almost makes it, you know, among missionaries kind of a badge of courage in some way. And so I think there's part of it is just being young and a little bit naive. There's a hymn about missionary work in the Mormon Church that refers to the fervent zeal of youth. And I think that we all kind of had that to a certain extent. And so on one hand, you kind of know it's dangerous. On the other hand, you feel a little bit spiritually protected. There's probably a little bit of naivety mixed in with all of it as well. So,
oh, yeah, young people are bulletproof. Yeah, my undergraduates always remind me of that, you know. And over time you find out that that's not necessarily the case. You did mention the article that your mom sent you from the Denver Post that dealt with all the tumult that was going on in Russia at the time. That's something I want to come back to, but I want to take this moment at this point to remind our listeners of what is going on in Russia. In 1991, the collapse of the Soviet Union led to basically a clean slate. Rewrite a constitution, figure out the new laws of what's going to go on. And initially, there was a great deal of religious freedom in Russia for 4 or 5 or so years. But the Russian Orthodox Church was becoming more and more concerned about incoming missionaries from the United States and other parts of the world. And by 1997, they were implementing a new law that was radically restricting what religious minorities could do in the country. And that's when you were there, right?
Yeah, it was 1998 or 1997 when I arrived in the country.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's come back to that, because I want to, with that context in a few moments here, figure out what actually happens on the trip. But I'm still not quite there yet. I'm still trying to figure out the logistics, and you need to help me with this. Who paid for this trip?
I did. The missionaries pay for themselves on their missions.
Did that become a big burden? I mean, that's could you give us an idea how expensive that was? Or
yeah, I can't remember the exact figure, but kind of what they've done now. It used to be that missionaries going to different countries would end up paying different amounts of money to live from month to month. So you can imagine a missionary serving in Europe versus a missionary serving in South America. There'd be quite a big discrepancy there, and that would make it harder on some families than on others. And so at some point, the church sort of equalized this by every missionary pays the same amount to the church each month, and then they you get a stipend for how much you need. So it kind of turns out that missionaries in areas that have a lower cost of living are subsidizing other missionaries to a certain extent. But that's all, you know, it makes it easier for people to plan to be able to serve without knowing where they're going to be. A lot of missionaries save for their whole lives. Growing up, I had a little bank that had three compartments, and one was for spending money, one was for tithing money, and the other was for savings money or mission money. And so I put away, you know, every time that I was paid, that was just kind of how I was raised, was saving money for something like that, for a mission or for the future. So I ended up paying for half of my mission, and then my parents paid for the other half, was the arrangement that we had come to. There's also available for missionaries whose families may not have the resources, who do want to serve. There are funding opportunities available through the church, and they try to keep it on a pretty local level, so people from that missionary's home congregation can contribute directly to their mission and feel like they're a part of it, and it becomes a little more personal than just, you know, contributing to a general missionary fund. But they make it possible for anyone who has a desire to serve to definitely do that.
That's absolutely fascinating, especially the aspect where everybody pools their money and then they even it out again. Again, somebody in, I don't know, Bolivia might be subsidizing somebody who goes to France. And I can also imagine the exchange rate prices have a big effect on how much things can afford. You know, sometimes
how far
when
your mind goes.
Yeah, so I can. And even halfway through your mission, there might be a devaluation of the currency, which radically changes how expensive that mission is for you. Let me ask you this. So you get to Russia. Where did you live? Did you live with other Mormons? Were you with a host family? What was the living arrangement like?
So we lived in a rented apartment. It's a great arrangement. It's just myself and my one companion that I was assigned, so two of us. Sometimes there will be you know, two companionships or three companionships in an apartment, but we always just had the two of us. And it works well. It kind of facilitates the strict lifestyle and routine that you live as a missionary, just with, you know, you're going to bed at a certain time, you're getting up at a certain time, you're doing gospel study, you're, you know, it's nice to be able to have your own space to do that and to kind of follow that regimen and that kind of thing.
Was this around a local ward that was there, or they just, you know, say, hey, you're in Moscow, go find a place to live, and here's an apartment guide?
No, actually, the mission president that I mentioned earlier, he sort of runs things in a particular city or set of cities, and he has an office staff made up of some of the missionaries who have been called to serve in that area, and the office missionaries help out with a lot of the logistics of getting registered with your visas and all the different documentation and paperwork you have to do. They maintain apartments, because sometimes missionaries will get transferred in and out of an area, but the mission will hold that apartment over time. And so maybe I'm in an apartment for 5 months with my companion, and then we move on somewhere else, and some other missionaries will come and live there. And so that's at least the way that it was run in my mission. I can imagine that in different places in the world it might be done differently, but it made it really convenient for us.
Yeah, I can imagine. It takes some other worries off your mind when you're in the 2 months of missionary training going on.
We still had to coordinate with our landlady from time to time.
Yeah. Now, I had just mentioned that Moscow, and I'm not sure you taught in Moscow, but is Moscow where you were primarily missionizing? Was that your 2 year stint there, or did you rotate to other parts of the country?
So when I was in Russia, there were, I think, 7 missions, I guess, including the Ukraine. And I was called to the Rostov-na-Don mission, which is in the south of the country. It's along the Black Sea. The cities of Volgograd, Sochi, Krasnodar were also part of my mission area, where those of us who were called to that mission all, you know, kind of stayed in that that part of the country. And there were, as I said, 6 other different Russian-speaking missions at the time.
Mm-hmm. So a little bit different than Moscow from where you were. Did you find a big difference between Moscow and where you ended up, or was it, this is all pretty much the same?
You know, it's through my eyes as a missionary, on one hand, it's all just totally foreign, and mm-hmm. so the commonalities almost stand out as much as the differences, but there are certainly differences. It would be like, you know, going from New York City in the United States, say, to, I don't know, I want to say Atlanta, but probably a smaller city than Atlanta, but something more southern, where the culture is a little bit different, and especially when I went to smaller cities like Krasnodar. I think in a lot of places there's the big city sort of ethos and way of interacting, and then in a smaller city where life moves a little bit slower and people are a little bit more friendly, and that kind of thing. So,
now, you also mentioned that you were paired with a companion. Is this somebody that you knew from missionary training school? Was it somebody completely new? And was it the same person that you were with for 2 years, or was there some rotation? They mix you up a little bit.
There's definitely rotation, but I had a companion in the MTC who I'd never met before, and then when I arrived in Russia, I was assigned another companion. I had never known her either. Sister Spencer was her name. We went by our last names there. I was Sister Pond the whole time I was a missionary. But it turned out that with my first companion, we actually had a lot in common. We were both students at BYU. We were both actually English majors, and we both came from the Denver metro area.
Did you know each other before going to Russia?
We didn't.
Well, that's weird.
So, yeah, we used to joke that it took Russia to bring us together. Mm-hmm. So I was together with that companion for 5 months in the city of Volgograd. Then I was in the city of Rostov, and I had one companion there for about 2 months, another companion for about 7 months, and then I finished up the last 2 months of my mission with one final companion. Normally, 2 months is considered a pretty average, maybe even a long time to be with a companion, but because we had fewer sisters than elders in my mission, the sisters tended to spend a long time with each other.
Okay. And have you still retained communications with these folks?
Yeah, I have, actually. Since I've been living on the East Coast and just recently returned to the West Coast, I haven't seen them a lot, and one of my mission companions was actually from Canada. But we've definitely all maintained contact, and I've gotten wedding announcements, and we read each other's blogs and things like that, too. So.
Oh, really neat. That's very cool. Now, the next thing I have logistically to ask you, so you land, the airplane lands, you meet with the resident bishop or the mission president who's in charge of stuff there. Do you get a couple days or weeks to adjust to the new environment, or do you just hit the ground running and say, hey, time to do missions, you're up at 5 a.m. tomorrow?
Yeah, we did really hit the ground running. I got there my very first day. I was, as I said, my first city that I served in was Volgograd, but we all went first to the mission home in Rostov, where we met our mission president and got our companions and things. And we were there for about a day, and then we were leaving that night to go to Volgograd. But even for that day where we were in a city where we weren't necessarily going to end up, they still, you know, encouraged us to, you know, go out and do some missionary work. And so my very first day, I was there with jet lag, with knowing the language but not really knowing the language, going out and talking to people on the street and just, you know, trying to strike up conversations and things like that. So I didn't, there was no time to adjust. It was, you were set apart as a missionary before you went into the MTC, and now that you're here, like, the more you can learn, the quicker, the better.
Yeah. So take us to that very first day. And you said you're talking to people on the street. I know some people do the doorbelling or knocking on the doors. And if you can remember what it was like, that first moment, and you got up, you're walking out, and you say, okay, now I do my missionary thing. What happens that very first moment? What were you thinking?
I was absolutely terrified. I loved the missionary training center, and I was so excited to be a missionary. I had so much faith in what I was doing, and yet the first time I needed to walk up to a stranger and start talking about it, I was absolutely terrified. I was with a companion who was relatively inexperienced, who had only been in the country for about 4 months. And so both of us, in terms of language skill, were not great. And I actually wrote in my journal that night after doing that I felt like I was a religious freak. And I, you know, I wasn't necessarily questioning my decision or anything like that, but it was a really hard experience. And I think that I came across probably as terrified as I felt, and it wasn't a very successful experience. And in general, street contacting and door knocking and things like that aren't the most effective ways to find people. And when they trained us, they told us that, and we were always encouraged to do other things, you know, to find ways to meet people, to get to know people, and before just, you know, cold calling or whatever. And so you know, but even knowing that, it was hard.
Let me hold off on the cold calling thing, because that is a fascinating aspect for me, and it's something that I talk about in some of my classes. The missionary work of the Mormon Church is utterly fascinating for me from a sociological vantage point here. But I want to stick with that first day. What do you remember, your first contact? What was that like? Describe it for us if you can.
Oh, I don't remember specifically. I mean, I was in Rostov, and my companion and I left the mission home, and we're walking down the street, probably one of the main streets in the city in that area, which main streets aren't the best place to find people. I didn't know that. It was my first day. And I think that my companion just said, why don't we go up to those people, and sort of nudged me. And I was like, I'm not going first. I've never done this before. You've done this before. Show me how to do it. I think it kind of went through my head, like, oh, no, she's just as scared as I am. And that was really a little bit unnerving as well. We just did it. And we walked up, and I don't remember what we said. It was, you know, probably introduced ourselves as missionaries and said we had a message about, well, Jesus Christ or families or something like that. And I think because it was a pretty busy street was part of the reason we didn't have a lot of success. I think a couple people probably stood and talked to us for a minute or two before moving on, and some people just, I don't have time, I don't want to talk, or whatever. I don't remember that we made any contacts that would be lasting for missionaries to follow up on. That was my very first experience. And it wasn't always like that, but that first day it certainly was.
Yeah, it wasn't always like that. Tell me about that. Does the process get easier as the weeks and months progress? Was there ever a point in time where you said, oh, I'm comfortable doing this?
Yes and didn't know. Once you're in your own area, and, you know, like, we moved into our apartment in Volgograd, and we had our neighborhood, and there were already some appointments set up for us with some people, and you can, you know, you start working on other things, you know, and you know that you have, like, a life and a community there, and you have places that you're doing service at a hospital or teaching English, or you have your congregation that you go to every Sunday, then it's a lot easier to reach out more in the community and even to do that street contacting and to knock on doors and things. But I think there's always, like, a part of me, at least, that it wasn't ever really my cup of tea. Total. You can kind of bracket and shut out the fear and the awkwardness, and it becomes routine, and you know what to say and what works better for when people come to the door or something like that. But for me, there was always that kind of dread. I think there were extroverts. There were other missionaries who were much more extroverted than I was, who liked it more. I remember one elder, Elder Smith, worked with us one day, and just watching him talk to people on the street, that was really the day when I caught a vision. It got a little bit easier for me, because he was just talking to these people, and he was smiling and having a great time and just getting to know people and making friends, and I realized it's easier for him because he's not thinking about himself and how awkward he feels. Like, he's thinking about them, and he's genuinely interested in these people and in getting to know them. And that was really sort of a paradigm shift for me that made it easier for me going forward. One of the things that missionaries talk, there's a story about President Gordon B. Hinckley, who was a former president of the church, who tells a story from his mission about how he was frustrated, and he served a mission in England and wrote a letter home about how he just didn't know if he wanted to keep going, and his father wrote back to him and said, "Forget yourself and go to work." And that is kind of a mantra that a lot of missionaries would use, and just the idea of forgetting about your own self and your own whatever may be bothering you, and instead focusing on the people that you're there to serve and trying to develop charity and love for them. And that, I think, probably makes a big difference and makes it a lot easier for a lot of missionaries to be able to do that day after day.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about your typical day. So not necessarily the first day, but take an average day over the 2-year period that you were there. What did that look like? What, from getting up in the morning, what were the typical activities till bedtime?
It's a pretty set regimen that all missionaries follow. You wake up at 6:30 in the morning, and then you have an hour of scripture study individually, and then an hour of companionship study together. And if you are in a foreign country and you're, I think, within 2 months of arriving, then you take an extra hour for language study in the morning. So you end up leaving the apartment around 11 o'clock, and hopefully you have appointments set up to teach all day long. You teach people in their homes, and an ideal day is to have several appointments set up where you teach people discussions. There is a set of 6 discussions on different topics that you would go over with people. And
now, who are you teaching here? Are these recent Mormon converts, or who are these?
They could be. They're either people who are, we would call them investigators, people who are interested in learning more about the church, who would invite us into their homes. And a lot of those were people who we met either on the street or through door contacting. But most of them, as I said, that was not the most effective method. Most of them were people who we met either through current members of the church or through the service that we were doing in the community, or just different people sometimes approached us, different things like that. So they would be those investigators, or it would be recent members of the church, or sometimes we would just call on any current member of the church just to check in with them and to for various things. And so hopefully in a day we'd have several appointments, but when we didn't have appointments, then we would use that time for finding people to make appointments with. And you'd go all day. We would take a break for dinner and then go back out in the evening. We didn't do really like finding or approaching people we hadn't met before after it was dark. So we would usually try to have appointments already set up for that point. But then you would have to be back in your apartment by 9:30. You call and check in with other missionaries every night to make sure that everyone's accounted for. And then go to sleep by 10:30 and get up the next day and do it all again.
Yeah. So that finding part, you said finding, is that, you know, the typical image of the doorbelling or walking up to somebody in the town square, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, it could be that, or it could be, like I said, we would try anything else we could, whether it was teaching English classes in the community to make some friends and then get to know people and find out if any of them were interested. It's so much easier when you know a person and you can know how appropriate it is to share your religion and in what way and with what timing, or if they have friends or others who are interested. So I definitely did my share of knocking on doors and talking to people, but if I could think of any other way to meet fresh people to teach, I would do it over that.
That harkens back to what we were talking about before, too, about cold calling. And you mentioned that your mission president and the folks in the Missionary Training Center pretty well know that just knocking on a door, having somebody answer and saying, "Hi, I'm here, I'm a Mormon," is not going to be the most effective way to bring somebody into the church. Instead, you're building, I guess, from what you're saying, teaching English classes, you're building network contacts, right? Is that the more effective way? What did you find that was most effective in bringing people in?
Absolutely. I think that was so. I think the number one most effective way is through members of the church who have friends who are interested, or family members, or things like that, because there's already a relationship of trust there between those people, and they've already been prepared and expressed some interest. And so when we come in, we're kind of picking up where there's already been a lot of, you know, seeds planted, and groundwork laid. So those were probably the most successful. Otherwise, you know, at the end of each discussion with someone, if that person was still interested or if they weren't, we would ask them if they knew of anyone else who might be. And like I said, through community service, just talking to everyone all the time about who may be looking for something in their life and spiritually.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that you pointed out in your Wall Street Journal column, and that we mentioned a little bit earlier here, was that about 80% of all Mormon missionaries abroad are men. That means, as a woman, you certainly were in the minority in the missionary community. So, from a gender perspective, what was your experience like? Did you perceive any difference in the missionizing process between men and women?
I personally didn't. I mean, we follow the same schedule. We taught the same discussions, and so as far as like what you're really there to do as a missionary and your primary responsibility, there was no difference between what the men were doing and what the women were doing. The difference is that in the leadership structure, men are called to positions of responsibility where women aren't. And so you have the mission president, and he'll have a couple of assistants, and then the mission is divided into what are called zones. Usually each city would have one or two zones in it, and then within each zone there were districts where you had maybe like four or five companionships in a district. And so we as sisters would be members of a district, but our district leader and our zone leader and our mission president were all men. Some women, this bothers them, and they want to lead, and they would probably be really good leaders. For me, when I was a missionary, it wasn't really on my radar. I don't think I had that kind of ambition, didn't want that kind of politics. I mean, I really just wanted to teach. I was there for the Russian people, and I think, you know, some people, you know, they want to aspire to those leadership positions. Others, they feel like it takes away from their chance to be teaching and, you know, really down in the weeds of missionary work. But I guess just knowing before I even left that that wasn't going to be part of my missionary work, I just didn't give it a whole lot of thought.
Did you perceive that Russian people were more interested in talking to women who approached them than men? And I assume that you were always paired with another female.
Yes, I always was. I think it probably went both ways. I think that there were probably certain people who were more willing to talk to men and certain people who were more given to talking with a woman. We did have it set up so that if there was ever a single woman who was interested in having discussions, the sisters would meet with her, or if there was a single man, that the elders would meet with him. So, you know, other than that, though, I think I'm sure it worked for us and against us in different situations.
Yeah, I can imagine. Let me ask you this, because the same thing that I asked our street preacher a couple months ago. What was the scariest moment you faced?
That's an interesting question. I think there were a few times. It's hard to pin down one moment. A couple stand out in my mind, though, just where we would be walking down a street. This happened at least twice on my mission. And we were about to turn and go a certain direction and just having a really strong feeling, don't walk down that street. and just that it just wasn't safe, or that there was some reason that it just wouldn't be a good idea. And so we just left. And the first time that that happened, I remember thinking, am I going to find out tomorrow that someone was murdered there or something? And, you know, of course, you never hear anything. But for the most part, I didn't feel a lot of fear, which in retrospect, I probably should have felt more than I did, considering the fact that I was wandering around a foreign city approaching anyone who would talk to me.
Yeah, and this is where I want to come back and talk a little bit about the Russian context now specifically, because you're doing this in 97, 98, and you know the Russian Orthodox Church was really ramping up its rhetoric against religious minorities. Not only were they pursuing remedies from all these influx of missionaries coming in, you know, trying to prohibit them constitutionally or through other regulatory means, but they were, you know, ramping up the rhetoric. The language is getting pretty strong here.
Mm-hmm.
And one could only imagine that this is going to make life a little bit more difficult for you. So tell me about the religious landscape, the religious environment that you're operating in Russia in 1997 and 98. Do you think that affected the way you went about doing things, or the way that people interacted with you on the street or in English classes?
I think it must have. And I think that those who were less interested or more frightened sort of self-selected away from spending much time with us.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, you mentioned, at first, there's this influx of people from different faiths, and that included, some faiths and some, more suspect groups as well. And at first, people were really intrigued, really curious. But I think that about the time I arrived on my mission is when there started to be a backlash. There was, I can't remember what it was exactly, but there's some sort of event that happened with, I think it was the White Brotherhood, and there was someone who had gotten involved with that group who died somehow, and it was a real big scare. And all of a sudden, the Russian Orthodox Church really capitalized on that by saying, look, any foreign religions are dangerous, and they are not Russian religions. If you are a Russian, you are Russian Orthodox. And people were really worried about this. And so Russians are also by nature extremely superstitious, and so I think that that played in a little bit too. But there, and I think just like in other places, sort of the demographic way that some of this plays out, you get in a big city, it kind of hits first, and then these waves of information and other things slowly move outward into the rest of the country. And so where we were, there were still quite a few people who were intrigued and who were curious and willing to talk to us, but there was also starting to be some real fear of anything that was a foreign faith of any kind. So, there were definitely people that we got to know, that we became really close to, that we really loved, who never were able to make that transition and join the church. There were some people who were more interested in talking to us about America than they were about religion, but having had it be suppressed and for so long that when people really had a chance to finally meet someone and talk to them about it, a lot of them were just fascinated, even if they weren't interested.
Yeah, I had a similar experience when I was in Chile. I had been there right after the Pinochet regime stepped down, and trying to talk to Chileans about that experience, they didn't want to. It was something that, like, hey, we got this beyond us, let's move on. Some people were curious, and some people did want to come to me and talk about those issues, but I can only imagine it was the same thing in Russia. Were you ever afraid of being arrested or deported during this time?
No, I think this goes back to, what we talked about before, that I kind of felt spiritually protected, but we also had a strong infrastructure just with the other missionaries, members of the church. We had a lot of Russian friends that we could call if we ever needed anything. We were all registered with the government. The LDS Church is really firm about going through the front door, and that's part of the reason, I think, for the safety of their missionaries.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever get a chance to meet with members of other religious minorities, maybe some Pentecostals or Baptists or Jehovah Witnesses or anything? And if you did you share any stories?
It's interesting. There was really a sense of competition around this more than of camaraderie, I think, among these small groups. I remember once when we were on the street in Volgograd, we were walking through sort of a park area and talking to people, and they kept saying, we just already talked to your friends just before you, and we realized that some Jehovah's Witnesses had seen what we were doing and had gotten a couple hundred yards in front of us and were talking to people before we got to them. there was one incident where some people invited us in, said they were really interested, got us sitting down. We started talking about our message, and then they revealed that they were actually Jehovah's Witnesses, and they tried to save us from who we were and what we were doing and that kind of thing. So, other than that, you know, like we would meet people who belonged to other churches, and we taught some members of a Pentecostal church who had not gone for a long time, and at the end of it all, they just said to us, thank you so much for helping us rediscover our Pentecostal faith, and, you know, we're actually not interested in joining yours, but we can never thank you enough for bringing us back to religion and faith, and so lots of different things that happen like that.
That's interesting. One of the themes that we bring up on our show frequently is the issue of religious pluralism, religious competition. And you mentioned that there is this competitive nature to it, as you're saying, oh, the Jehovah's Witnesses, they're 100 yards ahead. Maybe we should do an end around and try to get to these people. I'm sure there is some aspect of that. But as you say, with the Pentecostals, I mean, there's some synergy to this, that where, you know, people interact with one another. Competition isn't always a zero-sum thing. It's oftentimes a positive sum. Aspect where,
right.
you learn about each other, you learn about yourself, and you strengthen your own values and ideals as well. Let's lighten things up a little bit and ask you, were there ever any humorous moments on your mission trip? Anything that really stands out as a belly buster?
Oh, certainly. This is another one where I just wish I could remember more specifics. I do remember with my last companion at one point, we were knocking on some doors and for some reason, I don't remember what she said, but whatever it was, it made us both just crack up. And we kind of got control of ourselves and moved on to the next door and knocked. And as we were waiting for the person to come to the door, she said it again. And we both were laughing so hard we had tears coming down our cheeks. And when someone opened the door and saw us there, they were like, hello. And we could hardly stop laughing just to get out what it was that we, you know, were trying to say. And I think that, you know, eventually that person, I'm so sorry. Here's who we are. And we just couldn't stop laughing. And we finally had to just stop knocking doors that day and go do something else. Because, you know, sometimes you just get one of those things. So.
Yeah. Any other moments stand out in your mind of things that...
I mean, I remember a lot of good times, you know, dinner at people's houses, and we used to have sport nights where we would play some games and stuff with members of the church and their friends, and, you know, we always had jokes about it. We got so dirty walking around those streets, and missionaries had a lot of jokes about, you know, it's a two-year camp out, or you know, when it was really icy and we would all fall down, we would count up the number of times and add it up as one of our statistics for the end of the week, like how many discussions did you teach, how many times did you fall down, so there was a real sense of, you know, fun about a lot of it at the same time, too.
So you are keeping a diary, you're keeping a record, you're keeping some statistics on this. Do you have any indication of how many people that you brought into the church, either personally or with your companion at any point in time?
Yeah, it's hard to say exactly because, as I said, sometimes you move in and out of an area and you'll begin teaching someone and then maybe you'll go home from your mission and someone else will finish. And that happened a lot as I moved from one area to another. I think that overall, there were probably about 10 people, maybe more, that I was a part of at one stage in the process. There was only one person where I found, taught, and baptized that person all the way through all of the discussions. But there's a lot of synergy among all the missionaries sort of along those lines.
Yeah, so multiple contacts with one person will lead that one person in. So it's hard to say specifically that you did that in person. I can understand. Any idea of your batting average? I mean, in terms of, you say, you know, 10 people, you think you really got close and brought in, but, you know, how many people did you meet? 20, 200,000? So what's the ratio there?
Oh, gosh. I mean, when you think about every person that I would talk to every single day, everywhere that we went, it's not a huge proportion, and it's definitely different than someone, for example, who my brother served in the Philippines, and I think they're culturally they're much more open, religiously they're much more open, and he definitely was involved with way more people joining the church, I think, than I was. But I don't know, there's something just about the ones who do that kind of makes it all worth it.
Yeah. Well, one of the things you brought up in your Wall Street Journal article is that you mentioned, we don't have a great success rate in terms of every person we meet, we bring in. It's, you know, a few people and it's through multiple contacts and things. And when we think about missionizing, people often think about bringing that person in. As I was talking here, the, you know, success rate, how many people did you bring in? We oftentimes forget about the effect that the mission trip has on the missionary. And that's something that you mentioned in the Houses of Worship column that you did for the Wall Street Journal that I thought was very fascinating. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, certainly. There really is this sense that in some ways, some of the most important converts of missionary work are the missionaries themselves. There's a scripture in the Doctrine and Covenants, which is one of the Mormon books of scripture, that says that if you work and labor all of your days and bring but one soul to God, that how great will be your joy with that soul. And so there's also this sense that it might be one other person that you save, but it might just be yourself. And the idea of missionaries coming to God and part of the program is personal conversion, that you can't really be an effective missionary unless you're sharing something that you really believe. And so a lot of that maturity that missionaries gain really comes from spending this time, really studying and learning and internalizing a lot of pro-social behaviors and characteristics like sacrifice and like charity and faith and, becoming so responsible for such a huge work. I mean, missionary work is really sink or swim, and missionaries are asked to do nothing less than defend a theology, which is really staggering as a 19-year-old young man, if you think about it. I mean, mm-hmm. None of these missionaries have been to divinity school. None of them have, studied and devoted their lives to this. It's just something that they believe in, that they want to share. And so, that really plays into what we're talking about before with the effect on missionaries and who they become, and rising to the occasion of these very high expectations and becoming someone different and someone more converted.
Yeah, and as you mentioned in your column, the people who do the missionary work end up being some of the most fervent congregants in the future through the rest of their lives.
Yeah, I think when you've sacrificed on behalf of something, it becomes even more precious to you in some way. Yeah. And I think that that's certainly what's going on with returned missionaries.
So let me finish off with this question. If you had to do it all over again, what might you want to do differently, or how would you view the process differently? And do you have any advice for potential missionaries who are listening in, be they Mormon or Methodist?
Oh, wow. I'm not sure. I mean, I gave my heart and soul to my mission in a way that I don't think I've done for anything before or since that. And so in that sense, I wouldn't do anything differently. I would say, certainly I'm now older and I have more life experience and perspective, and some of the things that I did, I look back and I just think, oh, how could I have did? But I was young, and that was part of that zeal of youth and who I was and who missionaries are.
Yeah, welcome to the old people club. That's going to still continue. You're not done experiencing that. So.
I'm sure. I would say to missionaries of any faith, I think, to me, one of the most important things in missionary work is to be authentic and to have personal integrity about what you're teaching and how you're teaching it, to have a closer relationship with God, and to remember that missionary work is about them. It's not about you. And developing that charity and love for others was what I felt helped me to be the most effective as a missionary. I'd also say keep a journal. It is so fun to go back and look and see who I was at that really passionate and intense time of my life that was so formative. So it was really memorable.
Well, you're a superb writer, just reading your Wall Street Journal column that you had. Any thoughts of ever making this into a published memoir?
That has actually occurred to me in the past before. I kept, like I said, a really, really detailed journal, and so I guess it's always a possibility. It seems like a lot of work, but it could happen.
That'd be really neat. Well, great. This has been a fantastic visit. I've learned quite a bit about what goes on in the missionary process, and so, Allison, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you for having me. I love what you're doing, and I'm really thrilled to be a part of it, so thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.